very often I find that being a musician is the ultimate limiting belief, because, you know, by being so free psychologically that you're able to give up that thought and go, yeah, I'm so free that I can play, or I can, you know, express myself in a way where I don't mind being judged as not a real musician, or I don't mind being judged as breaking the social code of being a musician.
Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is musician's peak performance coach, Nick Bottini. Nick is a well-studied musician who's taught at various levels, eventually rising to the head of Music London Schools. He transitioned into performance coaching after discovering the steps that unlocked his own musicianship. Since then, he's helped everyone from students to top professionals, sports figures, and even entrepreneurs. During our interview, we spoke about when a musician needs a performance coach, why visualization doesn't always work, how to get into a state of flow, and much more. I spoke with Nick from his home in London. I think the big question that many musicians, artists, producers, engineers might have is, why would you need a performance coach?
I think the truth is that people don't need a performance coach, but some people are attracted to pushing themselves beyond what they can do on their own. And some people are very curious about whether whether there are limits that exist for them or not. And they want, you know, like the way that a car has mirrors, so that you can see your blind spots behind you, and sort of some people seek that out for their own development, their learning, and that they're very curious about, like, what that can be, what can be created there. So that's, it's not everybody that needs it, I don't think. Not everyone sees the value of it. Other people find their own way to do it, to sort of develop in their own way. But some people are very drawn to that kind of approach.
Okay, Nick, then who needs it the most in your eyes?
The people who are drawn to it. The people who are drawn to it. So I've worked with jazz musicians, rock stars, athletes, entrepreneurs. Some of those people happen to be people who are drawn to it. And there's lots of other people who don't use those services, you know. You know how sometimes, you know, certain subjects or certain, I don't know, like certain, you ever had a song that's just, or a band that's just really caught your attention, and it's kind of, there's something curious about it, and it's just the colors, or the way that they write the lyrics. There's just a fascination. There's something that we can't quite put our finger on. So I don't think it's, you know, because, you know, when people have a business, or when they teach, or when they're passionate about something, it's easy for us to kind of go, well, everybody needs it. I don't think that's true. And I don't think that's an integrity to say that. But what I do think is that when there's this beautiful kind of soulmate fit with a subject, or when there's a soulmate fit with, you know, I value this exploration of being coached around my mindset around something, real magic happens there, that real miracles happen for people. So you know, there's all sorts of, you know, because I've worked with people at the beginning of their career. I've worked with people who are sort of in a more established kind of position. And I've seen magic happen with all of those kinds of people. But it's something about the energy that they're in, the kind of headspace that they're in, that brings them to the conversation. You know, and for me, like, you know, I had, when I was training as a musician, you know, I had some sort of challenges that I was facing, sort of, I guess, like, you could call them mental health challenges, or sort of overthinking challenges, challenges with the education system. But at that point, I hated the idea of sort of thinking about therapy or something. It didn't seem like it fit with my model of the world. It felt like there was a stigma around it. But yet, something that seemed like education, or sort of high performance psychology, or understanding flow, like those, that was a story that appealed to me. And it did impact my mental health. It did impact my sense of well-being and my health, and what have you. The words were different, but the packaging was the one that sort of resonated with me. And that's been my path, you know. So I think there's something about that. It just resonates with certain people, and the call to it, you know.
Yeah, it's funny, because you can say, well, therapy and coaching are similar. I mean, they're not exactly the same, but they're similar. And someone who is, in my case, for instance, you feel like you hit a wall and you want to go to another level. Well, who are you going to go to for that? Well, and you know, you're going to go to a coach. A therapist might help you on some mental issues, mental health issues, but not necessarily take you to that extra level that you want to go to. Am I right?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, and I think there is there's an important overlap between those two disciplines. And I think probably generally speaking, coaching as a profession is more sort of forward focused, more goal focused. And therapy often is about sort of getting people to healthy or to normal or to some sense of being fixed. You know, so again, it's the words that people use. I'm not saying it's the truth. And there are lots of therapists that will sort of go further, but my specialism, I suppose, is it's more of a kind of educational, more of a kind of transformational, aspirational sort of intervention. You know, so yeah, there is a difference.
Okay, I want to go there in a second, but let's talk about your background first. And I know you started as a musician, and I want to hear about that, but also your transition into what you're doing now.
It's an unusual sort of combination of different events, really. So I trained originally as a violinist, a classical violinist, and had dabbled with playing a little bit of saxophone at school, which is a bit of a weird combination of instruments. But I started on violin. And was, I guess, you know, a successful musician in my little, you know, big fish in a little pond. I was a successful little musician. And like a lot of music students, I got to university, music college, and encountered, you know, certain gaps in my training. And it frustrated me. And I got really, really curious about, you know, why was it that I wasn't taught these things, or what was lacking, you know, in my training. And I was... There was an opportunity to study music psychology as a an elective, as a module in my university course, and it introduced me to this whole world of studying the mindset of top performers. So I started reading, you know, studies about competition winners or expert performers, particularly like expert violinists. I was interested in. And I got really fascinated by kind of studying people, and because I felt like I wanted to catch up. And so it became, over time, it became this sort of obsession of mine to really investigate, well, how does excellence in music or excellence in learning or excellence in sort of personal transformation or life change, like how does that work? Not just how can I achieve it for myself, but how does it work? So that, because I felt like if I'm going to change myself in the ways that I wanted to change myself, I'd have to understand how it actually worked, because I felt like I couldn't just do what everybody else was doing. I wanted to have some sort of secret source. And I felt that these studies and sort of reading around the topic would give me some secrets. So I really got the bug early on. So sort of early 20s, I got the bug for learning about how my mind works and how it could impact my music myself. And then, after sort of starting that journey, I really realized that I enjoyed teaching and learning how other people would teach children how to learn music and sort of develop the mindsets of successful musicians. So I became a teacher, trained as a teacher, and realized that, you know, over years of doing that in the music classroom, I realized that the bit that I loved the most was not just when I was teaching young people or, you know, young musicians, you know, how to prepare for performances and the details of music. The thing that I loved the most was seeing their sense of themselves change. So when they started to think about new possibilities, or when I'd meet with a child's parents and I'd hear them tell stories about, oh, we're not a musical family, and the kid would go, yeah, we're not a musical family, and they'd obviously have these beliefs about themselves that were sort of crying out to be changed or to be played with. And so I'd gently have these conversations, and I got more and more curious about, you know, what could I do as a teacher that would help unlock that child, that young person, and change their attitude to learning, so that they saw themselves in a different way, and then that would unlock their own ability to teach themselves and to go. So it's like I found this leverage point, which is more than just showing them what to do or showing them how to learn in one context. It was a much deeper leverage point, which was the kind of inner gain. And so that suddenly became a real, an intensifying of that fascination that I'd had with music psychology. And I really saw that I could make a huge difference with my music, but also it was a deeper leverage point for my own development as a musician. So I just went deeper and deeper and deeper into this thing, and eventually went on to study the art of coaching and to start practicing. And then, one thing led to another, and my various sort of contacts through music or my former students wanted coaching and that sort of thing. And it grew from there. And at a certain point, I left my educational leadership role that I had in music education and worked with artists and music industry professionals full time.
Well, let's come back for a second, because before you mentioned that you have a wide variety of clients that include musicians and artists, but also entrepreneurs and sports figures. Is your approach different, or maybe a better question would be, are their needs different?
Well, there are different needs. So what different clients will say at the beginning of speaking with me will be different. So an entrepreneur, for example, might be asking questions about making more money or work-life balance or stress, for example. A musician, like a concert soloist that I worked with recently was talking about sort of managing different performance situations and relationships and like the touring life and that kind of thing. So they have different things which are kind of on their mind. But I guess the interesting thing is that the conversation always ends up coming back down to a common ground, which is like, well, the question that I was sort of exploring, which is like, what is flow or what is high performance for a person, and what's your version of it? So that I find it fascinating, because they start it in one place, but then they end up coming to the essence of, simplicity and ease and sort of unlocking that fullest potential. But if you saw the conversations at the beginning point, it would sound very different. It's because of my background of sort of these various different parts of the music industry, I know enough about what they're talking about to sort of meet them where they are and then take them on a journey that proves to be useful for them. But it is a wide variety of different starting points.
Okay, but are you saying that then the end point or the point of transformation, let's say, is the same for everybody or near the same, similar?
In a way, yes, it is. Because when people talk about the flow state, or they talk about peak performance, if you talk to performers who have said that they've been in the zone, they'll often say that they don't have a lot on their mind. They'll often say that they kind of lost their sense of themselves. They weren't being so self-conscious. There wasn't a conversation going on, like, how am I doing? Am I doing this right? Is this going okay? Like, they're not having that conversation. They got a sense of space. They got a sense of time sort of not really mattering to them in the same sort of way. And my assertion is that's a universal across cultures, across job titles, ages. That's a fundamental truth of how human beings work. And when people suffer, or when they are struggling to perform in the way that they hope they can, it's because there's extra thinking that's in the way. And essentially, even though I don't necessarily say it in that way to the individual person that's in front of me, the direction that we're heading in is taking things off your mind. It is in simplicity, is in actually thinking less, letting the system kind of quieten down. And then this kind of intuitive right action. And they know what to do. These aren't people who I'm teaching how to play. These are people who that they're very skilled, but it's just the interference that we're getting rid of. So in a way, it feels to me like it's the same for everybody, but the starting point is just very different, you know. And the individual, the story that they're in is different. Obviously, it's very personal to them.
You know, it's funny, on a personal note that relates to that, and it's just a very minor thing. Whenever I have to use a teleprompter, doing an ad or even an intro for, you know, one of these podcasts, I find that if I don't think about it, I can zip through it with no problem, and there's no, you know, there's no stumbles or whatever. And as soon as I begin to think about it, I can't get through it at all. Mm. So, I mean, it's just a silly little thing, because it's not, it is performance, but nonetheless, it's something that, you know, rears its ugly head all the time, where I go, oh, I was thinking about it. Why don't think?
Yeah. and that, you know, it's funny, because you say it's like a silly little thing, but this is what we all do. And I do it too. It's like we can all think that, you know, I guess as adults, like we're meant to have our stuff together, and that with the certain, like some of the things that go on inside our head, as it were, we're not meant to sort of talk about it or sort of, it's meant to be easy. We're meant to know how that works, right? But what I find is that when I have these conversations and people kind of get into this space of being really honest about what it's like to be them, they all say like exactly what you're saying. It could be about a concerto or about, you know, a negotiation with a record label or you know, a live performance, like whatever it is, it's still the basic issue is like exactly what you're saying, that there's thinking that's creeping in there. And when it quietens down, life gets simpler, people. You know, so it's a very common experience, universal experience.
There are 15 simple mix fixes that can instantly take your mixes from amateur to pro level. These are the secrets that the top engineers know that most musicians don't. That's what you'll find in my Mix Fix playbook. Head to go.bobbyosinski.com/mixfix to check it out now. You know, I saw something on your website that I found interesting. It's that you don't teach mental techniques or visualization. And I've talked with other coaches that are very big into visualizations, and I know that's a possibility that works. But how did you come around to your method?
I did train quite extensively in some of those visualization methods, right? So this is not like a you know, a whim. Like I played with that stuff personally and with clients for a while, and what I found was sometimes we can have like a really powerful experience of visualizing and kind of imagining, and it's not, I'm not saying that it's, there's no place for it and no use for it whatsoever, but what I found is that very often when they think that they've got a particular exercise to do, like I'm meant to think this way, I'm meant to think positive, or I'm meant to think optimistically, or I'm meant to visualize it a certain way, what it innocently does quite a lot of the time for people is to, it makes certain kinds of thinking right, and it makes other kinds of thinking wrong. And then they kind of feel like they're stuck in this pass or fail, right or wrong kind of trap. And then they get, So when someone's like anxious, often I'll ask them about what they're anxious about, and they think, oh, I shouldn't be in this. I'm a musician. I shouldn't be in this state. I'm a professional. I do this for a living. I shouldn't be feeling it. And they're anxious about being anxious. They're worrying about the fact that they're thinking. So often if we kind of teach people that you should think this particular way, that they take it as a source of pressure. And it's often a kind of subtle thing. And then when a coach will sometimes say, oh, if someone says it's not working for them, they'll say, oh, you're doing it wrong, doing the exercise wrong. And it becomes this sort of spiral. So I found that by pointing people about the fact that it's actually letting go of the thinking, that then spontaneously we then have these more optimistic, more healthier, bigger, more inspiring thoughts. It's more of an organic process rather than trying to, this old metaphor of trying to program the mind. It's not quite how we work.
Yeah. You know, let's go there for a second, because I spoke with several guests about this recently. The fact that musicians tend to identify with being a musician. In other words, their whole persona is built around that identity.
Yeah.
And that could be dangerous. And again, from a personal experience here, I found that when I gave that up and went into another area of music, it was one of the happiest days of my life, where suddenly this weight was off my shoulder. I didn't have to identify as that any longer. Do you run into that?
Absolutely. It's one of the most foundational sort of conversations that I'm often having with people, because you know, you think about it often. Well, this is how I've encountered it anyway. Like when someone's studying or when they're an adolescent, often they kind of what's the word? They look up to people who are professional musicians, and so they go, one day I'm going to be a musician, right? And so they get there, and everything's about being a musician, and so it feels like they've earned that identity, and it feels like that's the thing they have to hold on to. It's a lot of, they put a lot of pressure on themselves to kind of live up to that thing, and they've got very often very strict and very you know, ideas which are based on what someone else has shown them, or how the industry used to be 20 years ago, or what they were taught by their teachers. They've got these very fixed ideas about what being a musician means as well, right? So very often I find that being a musician is the ultimate limiting belief, because, you know, by being so free psychologically that you're able to give up that thought and go, yeah, I'm so free that I can play, or I can, you know, express myself in a way where I don't mind being judged as not a real musician, or I don't mind being judged as breaking the social code of being a musician. That's freedom. And when people discover that for the first time, it really shocks them, because they've spent so long trying to hold on to that. And then it's like, oh wow, I wasn't free. So the ultimate free is like, you know, you, like that Charlie Parker quote, he says, like, you know, you master the horn, you master the music, and you forget all that stuff and just play. But it's like, well, it's exactly like that with the identity of being a musician, that you work up to, you know, all the knowledge that you have, but then you're so free that you don't have to be, you know, identify as a musician. And that's so what you said is such a common thing. It's not just musicians, it's also anyone that's got a reputation or like their identity of success or whatever. So that's really, really massive blind spot, especially for a lot of high performers.
You know, you explained that beautifully, and actually you just explained something that I've always wondered about, and that's the fact that you're building up to, your whole life is trying to be something, and once you are, it's different, then everything about it changes. So that's thank you for that. That was good. You mentioned also Just Play, the Miles quote, which is the title of your book. So let's talk about that. How did that come about? How'd the book come about?
Wow. Well, I was in a coaching training, and I had, I don't know, a few months into it, and it was the coaching training that first introduced me to the principles behind what I will teach the clients now. And this very sort of subtractive approach to sort of performance psychology. And I've been in it for a few months, and I'd done various trainings by this point before that, and I'd done a lot of the visualization stuff that we were just talking about. And I'd never felt so free, and I'd never felt so much myself, and I'd never felt so happy. And I remember sitting in the training and realizing, like, holy shit, I need to share this with people. And maybe it's not just me as a musician. Maybe it's all musicians. I've found something here that could be shared. So that night, and it scared me, because I thought I had the thought, oh, I need to write a book, and I didn't know anything about you know, how publishing worked. So it felt a bit too like someone else's job to do it. So I thought, well, probably, you know, this training seemed well established, and it seemed like something that was, there must have been somebody before me that had written a book for musicians, because, you know, I knew that this understanding was sort of being taught in businesses and what have you. And I looked on Amazon and stuff, and there wasn't a book introducing the three principles to musicians, and that scared me even more, because it's like, oh no, that's never been done. But, you know, I'd attempted to write things before, but I'd never really it'd never been so clear to me that there was a need for it. Because lots of people want to write books, but I think the reason this one actually got completed was because the need for it just felt so strong, and the impact it had had in my own life. I couldn't stop myself. It was like one of those projects that it really bugged me every moment it wasn't finished, you know. And of course, like, it also made sense to make sure that I shared it with, you know, some pretty well-known people, and to have their thoughts on it, and to have them read it, and to have them, you know, feedback that helped shape the book. So I was very fortunate to get Jacob Collier and various other people to read the book and to comment on it. And so I felt very, I was very lucky in how it, well, it was a lot of work, but I was very grateful that it turned out how it did, yeah.
I had a very similar experience with my first book. It was The Mixing Engineer's Handbook. This was 1998. And I would go to people and say, you can't write a book on this because it's so subjective. And there's just no way to do this. Everybody does it differently. You can't write a book on it. And I thought, oh, maybe I can. Because I wanted to learn a lot about this because I wasn't a good mixer at the time. And I went and I talked to the best mixers in the world, 25 of them. And that became a big part of the book. And it was also an endorsement. It's much the same thing where they're in the book already explaining how they do it. And there was a method. And there was something that everybody, you know, did pretty much the same and or came to the same conclusion in one way or another. But the interesting part is you've finished the book and you go, I don't know if you did this, but I bet you did. You think, well, I'm never going to do that again.
Yeah. I found that the last 2% was the hardest of all because it was
And then if it does well, then you have a publisher saying, oh, you have to write another one. You got to do another one, and going, okay. But it actually gets better after that. So, and you're into your second book now. So you're finding that out.
That's right. Absolutely.
What's the new book about?
Well, the new book is about how the music industry is evolving in the way that it's learning coaching as an emerging sort of route to mental health and high performance. Because behind the scenes, there's been, for decades, musicians have been using coaching, but it's not so widely. I mean, there are people who are sort of coming to it, but I don't think. It was only when I started working in that field and sort of asking people, you know, what their experience had been, that I'd realized how widespread it was that musicians were having coaching. So it's about coaching, how various different musicians and industry executives and entrepreneurs have used coaching and used the mindset side of their development to unlock what they're doing, particularly like trailblazers. That's what I'm really interviewing those people and speaking with them, how they've developed.
Yeah, it seems like people they feel free enough to talk about that now, and also their mental health, which, you know, if you're anywhere successful in the music business, your mental health suffers because the business, it's a byproduct of the business. Let's put it like that. But again, I think it's great that people are coming out and talking about that, where once upon a time, you know, you want to keep that as quiet as possible.
Well, yeah. But I think also to your point about the industry sort of, you know, causing that or bringing that about, I'd like to think that will change over time. I think when you hear these stories about, you know, there being a mental health crisis in the music industry, and I definitely agree that there are definitely some challenging circumstances that, say, live performers, and you know, and there's been, you know, some really quite unpleasant things in terms of like sexual abuse and various things. Like, working conditions haven't been very good quite often, but a lot of the time there's a culture among musicians and music industry professionals, and how the industry is sort of portrayed and how they talk about themselves that perpetuates it, you know. So I really see individuals all the time who are kind of being a stand for something different and for like healthy touring and sort of prioritizing health and having let's say mental health professionals on a tour, or you know, various, like, counselors at a festival. You know, the climate is changing. So I like to think that by creating our industry differently, by telling a different story, by kind of highlighting the strengths and the healthiest examples and the people who are really thriving and succeeding musically, I think we can change it. I don't think it's like a fait accompli. It doesn't have to be that's just the way it is. I think we can definitely change that, but often it comes down to the individual going, actually, no, it's interesting you say that. Let's see what else is possible. And so by creating it individually, we change the culture. You know, it's the same thing with like the entrepreneurial sort of revolution that you see, like, you know, I don't know, a few decades ago, it would have been a much less common conversation to talk about a musician as a business owner or as an entrepreneur. Whereas with the whole sort of DIY movement, that culture is changing and people are talking about themselves differently. I think it's the same with mental health. There's a lot of change happening culturally in the industry at the moment, I think.
I can remember early in my career, I was with a fairly successful band and we were playing 300, 320 nights a year. I can remember playing every night, every single night for months. And I can't tell you how long it was, but everyone was so burnt out that we were begging for a day off. And management kept on saying, you're hot. You have to keep on going. Make money while you can, which is all too often the case. And then, of course, you have people that are totally burned out on it, and you can't really give a great performance when you're like that. You try your best, but it's not coming out that way, unfortunately.
I think when managers, promoters, when the people who are more on the business side, when they understand how to get the best out of people, they don't do that anymore. You know, it's a kind of old-fashioned kind of paradigm, or it's increasingly old-fashioned. It still goes on, but very much so. But I think that's an example. It's not just the individual. It's also this kind of culture of, you know, grinding ourselves into oblivion. You know, we want to look after the talent. You know, it's important.
We want to look after ourselves.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. All right, yeah. Nick. This has been great. I really enjoyed speaking with you and your insight. You gave me many things to think about here, which is great. Last question. What's the best piece of advice that somebody imparted to you, or maybe something that you learned along the way?
Slow down. And what I mean by slow down is like allow the mind to quieten. So, because I used to do this, and I bet you've done a version of it, and I bet people listening will have done a version of it. We can often we kind of get rewarded by thinking quicker or thinking more or being cleverer. Right. And there's we get very the ego and the intellect can be very appealing. And I felt like I was very sort of addicted to that kind of sense of like achievement. But to actually allow myself to go in the opposite direction and realize that actually allowing the mind to settle naturally by letting go of the urge to kind of grab onto thoughts, just letting it settle. When you get into that state, or when you discover that dimension within yourself, then all sorts of levels of high performance get unlocked that we don't expect to find down there, because we've never let the mind actually quieten that slowly. It's like always having the foot on the accelerator pedal, when in fact, actually, if we realize that it's actually safe to take it off, we've got more control over how we're using our intellect. So the simple answer is slow down.
Would that be connected to meditation?
It gets mentioned in meditation traditions. Yeah, it does. Yeah.
Because it feels that, you know, that's somewhat the same thing. Slow your mind down, clear your mind.
There's links between, you know, meditative ways of being and the flow state and high performance and unlocking extra levels of, you know, achievement. So I think it, you know, it is mentioned in meditation, but it's, again, I think it's not the practice itself. I think there's something fundamental about how we work, and it's realizing that basically the mind is a self correcting or sort of self quietening system. The default is mental health. The default is peace. It's naturally in there. It's not something we achieve. It's just sort of like, you know, like muddy water sort of settles down and clears. the mind is right back. It naturally has this sort of self, you know, self-meditating kind of quality. So, yeah.
Well, very cool, Nick. Thanks so much for your time. This was great. I really enjoyed speaking with you. Hope we can do it again.
Yeah, no, my absolute pleasure. Lots of love to you. All right.
Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. You can also learn all about the latest in music, audio, and production news, and find out about openings for my latest online classes at bobbyosinski.com. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.